Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. If it appears to you that more children and adults are suffering from food allergies, you're right. That's according to the Food Allergy Research and Education Organization that says 32 million Americans have food allergies. Most are allergic to milk, eggs, peanuts, fish, or shellfish, at least here in the United States. On Smart Talk today, we examine what's behind the increased number of food allergies and what can be done to manage the allergies. Joining us on today's program is Dr. Krista Todorich, who is with the Penn State Hershey. She's an allergy, asthma, and immunology specialist. Dr. Todorich, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us is Katie Noss. She's a school nurse and the mother of a child who has a peanut allergy. Ms. Noss, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And joining us on the phone is Lisa Gable, who is CEO for Food Allergy Research and Education, also known as FAIR. Ms. Gable, glad to have you on today's program.
Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or a comment about food allergies, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Katie Moss, I want to start with you. Your son, Thomas, how old is Thomas?
He is 1.5.
He is 1.5.
Yep.
Okay. So he has a peanut allergy.
He does, yes.
At 1.5, how did you find out or discover that he had a peanut allergy?
That's a great question. The new research has shown that giving kids exposure to these types of allergens earlier makes them less likely to develop the allergy later in life. So I had read some of this research as a school nurse and decided to go ahead and give Thomas some peanut butter at 4 months old. We gave him the peanut butter and he did fine with it, no reaction at all. We gave it to him again at 6 months old and he developed some hives around his mouth. So we called our pediatrician and they said, no problem, just keep an eye on him, make sure things aren't getting worse. And thankfully for us, they didn't. For a lot of other people, they're not that lucky when they find out that their child has a food allergy. And they sent us to an allergist who did some testing, and they determined that he does have a peanut allergy and that his next reaction could be much worse. So they gave us an epinephrine, and actually it's called an AVQ, which is the new type of EpiPen, for him, and told us to strict avoidance was the only type of treatment that we could provide for him at this point.
Was he tested or exposed to other foods?
He was tested for fruit, but only because he had also eaten fruit that day. So they just wanted to rule out that he didn't have that. I had been curious about whether he would also be allergic to tree nuts, because sometimes there's some overlap there. But he hadn't had tree nuts at that point, so I guess you can't be tested for a tree nut allergy or any allergy unless you've had the food to show the reaction. Mm. So,
Dr. Todorich, is that common to test babies that young?
Yes, actually, we have no hesitancy in performing testing for really any age. And we often see the question of food allergy testing come up at the time that parents are introducing foods and when there becomes a question of whether a reaction was related to a food or not. So 4 months of age would be appropriate if you had had your son had had symptoms at that time. Anywhere onward after that would be appropriate for skin testing, or blood testing would be another option.
That was my next question. What kind of testing now? Thomas was exposed to peanut butter, but what is the testing that you as a doctor would do?
Yeah, so there are really two types of testing that we perform in order to evaluate for food allergy as well as other types of allergy. Those involve a skin test where we take some extract of whatever the food would be of interest, such as peanut in your son's case. We apply that on the skin with a prick, which introduces whatever that food may be into the top layer of skin to try to get your allergy cells to react, to see if we can notice that reaction taking place, causing a little hive on the skin or not, in some cases, hopefully. And that testing is available in the office standardly, can be performed as long as somebody is off antihistamines, and can provide an answer to a family with questions within about 15 minutes or so. When the blood testing is performed, we're looking for allergy antibody against the same food allergen, so against peanut in your son's case. That testing requires that we send you to a lab, you have blood drawn, and then there is some turnaround time typically till we have that result back. So the preference in a lot of cases for families as well as for allergists is to do skin testing so that we can provide an immediate result and have a discussion at that time and place, as opposed to you waiting and having some concern about what may be going on. However, the testing is fairly equivalent in terms of sensitivity. And so if skin testing is not available, if you're on antihistamines for some other reason, the blood testing is a viable option.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, my guess is that still most people don't test that early in life, that they probably experience it with a child first before seeking treatment or seeking testing.
Yes, that is true. And as you had mentioned with your son, what we find in terms of testing is that no test is 100% for something or against something. So nothing gives us true predictive value. Either positive or negative predictive value, meaning that we can do a test. I could do a test on myself potentially and have a positive test to peanut, although I eat peanut with no difficulty. And so before we perform a test that actually makes things more confusing for everyone involved, we like to have some history of reaction that would be suggestive of a certain mechanism by which we think a positive test would mean that you truly should avoid the food, let's say. There are some instances, and you bring up a good point about the tree nut allergy, that there is a coincidence between peanut and tree nut allergies. And so you'll see some varying practice here in that allergists may go ahead and test for tree nuts, even though they have not been introduced, in order to gain a sense of whether that could be a problem for your child or later on when you decide to introduce. And so you will see that practice in some cases. But in general, we try not to perform broad panel testing for food allergies because that often leads us into a confusing scenario.
What kind of tree nuts?
So tree nuts are any nut besides a peanut. A peanut is actually a legume, and it's not a nut. So any other nut, walnuts, pecans, almonds, Brazil nuts, macadamia nuts,
as long as it's
so
a
on
nut.
And so forth. That's right.
Well, yep. Okay. Lisa Gable, you're CEO of Food Allergy Research and Education, known as FAIR. We'll probably call it FAIR throughout the program. What is a food allergy?
Well, a food allergy, as the doctor was explaining, is basically where an individual has some element of sensitivity to that food. FAIR represents individuals, 32 million Americans, who have life-threatening food allergies. And those are individuals that when they accidentally ingest that food or ingest that food being unaware that they have a food allergy will suffer anaphylaxis.
Okay, so anaphylaxis, that's my next question. What is anaphylaxis?
You know what? I'm actually going to divert the answer back to the doctor.
Okay.
As I understand it, it is the shutting down of two systems, and there's so many variables in this disease that makes it one of the most complex diseases for us to actually get our arms around. But I'm going to let the doctor answer the more technical description.
We try to make this as conversational as possible. So, good, doctor.
So this is a very interesting question because the definition of anaphylaxis varies depending on whom you talk to. But as she mentioned, typically the accepted definition is when two systems are involved with symptoms that are suggestive of histamine release, which is the product that comes out of your allergy cells, or one of the products at least, that causes the symptoms that we see. So we're talking about things like having trouble breathing, coughing a lot because our airway has started to swell, having a lot of nasal congestion or runny nose, having hives, having an upset stomach, throwing up potentially, and then further on effects that we hope we don't encounter, such as low blood pressure and the need for intubation if you've gotten to the point of your airway being so involved. So the generally accepted definition, if you think of this across the board, is when you have two symptoms, basically, or two systems involved, hence anaphylaxis. So, most people will think anaphylaxis is kind of the end line where someone's lying on the floor in need of emergent intervention. And it's true, anaphylaxis is an emergency, but it can be defined sometimes by somebody simply having cough and their stomach hurting. That, by definition, involving two systems, the airway and the GI system, would constitute anaphylaxis, and those people would be appropriate to receive epinephrine as a treatment.
Mm-hmm. Lisa Gable, let me go back to you. I quoted to FAIR that 32 million Americans, including between 5.5 and 6 million children, and the numbers are actually growing of those who are experiencing food allergies. Do we know why the numbers are increasing?
Well, you raise an interesting point. The numbers have actually grown dramatically since 1998, and so we believe this is now becoming a severe public health crisis. What's interesting is we're also seeing a greater growth over the last 10 years amongst adults. Originally, the rise was related to children, basically two children in every classroom. There have been a lot of different hypotheses put forward as to what might be causing the rise. One is the hygiene theory, you know, the level of cleanliness of our cities and the use of various hand treatments and cleaning products that really make us a very, very clean society is something that you saw being introduced in the late 90s. The other is related to the gut microbiome. And again, I'm going to let the doctor explain this one because it's something that people are actually struggling with. There's a lot of research going on in this case with celiacs and Crohn's and colitis, as well as life-threatening food allergies. And so people are looking at research in that category, particularly as it relates to adults. And then as our mom on the telephone, the school nurse, indicated, is that there was a position that doctors were taking in the late 90s, instructing women who were pregnant not to eat the allergens during their pregnancy and also not to introduce the allergens to small children for a couple of years. My own daughter's 21, and I very much distinctly remember getting that guidance. Don't feed her these things. And the LEAP study, which was actually funded by FAIR, showed that it was aimed at peanut, and it had to do with children with eczema, which has a co-related relationship with food allergies, is it did show that if you began feeding the allergen to the child consistently, that potentially you would be able to mitigate the risk of that child's reaction to the allergen.
You know, when I hear that, and in my research for the program, I've read about this, and when I read that, I thought to myself, that sounds kind of dangerous, mm-hmm. that you are exposing the child to something that you know that they're allergic to and could have a severe reaction to. But
it feels counterintuitive.
It does sound counterintuitive.
But now the treatment that they're studying is giving your child small amounts of what they're allergic to, you know, and incrementally increasing it over time to develop the tolerance to be able to handle, you know, one or two peanuts in a cookie or something till they realize that they're eating that and then stop eating that. So it's interesting that that's now the treatment. We're going to give you the thing that you're allergic to a little bit at a time to build up a tolerance.
And this is probably a good time for me to say that if you're hearing this, not everything applies to everyone. Everyone is an individual, and if your child is showing signs of food allergies, I'm sure after the first time you took them to the doctor, but make sure that you consult with your physician so that, I mean, we're not giving diagnosing on the air, put it that way. But before we get into what Lisa was talking about a few minutes ago with another one of the reasons, I want to talk about some of the foods. You know, I mentioned some because we have a phone call here from someone who has another suggestion. But the foods that most often we see that people here in the U.S. are allergic to, what are they, Doctor?
So the eight most common that we see in childhood would be peanut, the tree nuts, milk, egg, soy, wheat, and then fish and shellfish, which are introduced at differing time points depending on the family and their routine eating habits.
Is there any one that's worse than the other?
No. So, you know, this is a concept that I address a lot with families in terms of what is allergy and what does that mean in terms of food allergy in the future. And I will say that that when we talk about food allergy as allergists, we really talk about this as a yes or no diagnosis. Do I have a food allergy or do I
not? There's no gray area.
There's no gray area. There's no, I have a mild food allergy or I have a severe food allergy. It is really all the same. And each food allergen has the potential to cause anaphylaxis and life-threatening symptoms. The other point I will make at this time, which I think is appropriate, is that there's often also a concept out there that you start with some sort of symptom and they will automatically progressively worsen over time. So the first reaction I had, as in your son's case, was hives around the mouth. And the next one is going to be worse. And the one after that will be even worse. And the one after that will be worse. And that's really not the way that food allergy works. It really is a yes or no question and can cause anaphylaxis with any ingestion. So it may be mild this time, could be quite severe next time. So in terms of is there one allergy that's worse or not, I say no, that they really are yes or no answers. And we do know, however, that with time, some of the food allergens are more likely to be outgrown. So egg and milk and wheat in childhood are more likely to be outgrown than, let's say, peanut or tree nut.
Is there, of those foods that you mentioned, is there one that, okay, maybe not more serious than others, but we see more often? My guess is there's a correlation between a food that is eaten more often, but one that you see more often.
Yeah, I think we see, obviously, our population is a little skewed. So we see folks of all who have allergies to all of those items. I do think that peanut in particular, because we've looked at this, has been increasing in prevalence, and we see that reflected in our practices as well.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk, and before we get back to our conversation, I want to remind you about an event we have coming up later this week, Wednesday, in fact. WITF, in partnership with State Impact Pennsylvania, will host a local retro report discussion from invasive species to the TMI shutdown. Some of Pennsylvania's top environmental headlines have roots in historical events. Join me Wednesday, October 23rd, this Wednesday, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the WITF Public Media Center, as I host a retro report screening and panel discussion. We'll talk about climate change, invasive species, water quality, and much, much more. Register to attend to WITF.org/events. I know that Secretary Cindy Dunn from the Department of Conservation will be here, as well as someone from Penn Future, the environmental group Penn Future, and maybe some other guests as well. But go to WITF.org/events and become part of that conversation on Wednesday night. On today's program, we're talking about food allergies, and our guest is Lisa Gable, CEO for Food Allergy Research and Education, also known as FAIR. Dr. Krista Todorich, a Penn State Hershey Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Specialist, and Katie Noss, a school nurse and mother of a child with a peanut allergy. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Lisa in Lancaster. Lisa, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My call in today deals with those of us who have a corn allergen and cannot be recognized here in the U.S. It is recognized in Europe and even listed on all your food items in Europe, but it is not recognized in the U.S., and that's a very dangerous thing to have because most of your medications contain corn.
Mm. So, Lisa, before we go to our panel to address your question, how did you find out that you were allergic to corn?
I found out the hard way, sir.
That's what I figured, yeah.
30, and my daughter has it, and we found out that five other relatives in our family have it. So we are doing a genetic research because I was diagnosed with multiple rare disorders this summer. And it's just very difficult because I have to have all my drugs compounded. If I go into the hospital, I have to have somebody, I either have to be alert or somebody has to be alert because there's so many mistakes, even starting with using Purell at all the hospital stations, which contains ethanol, the same thing you put in your gasoline tank, which is made from corn.
Mm. Hey, Lisa, good luck in managing that, but thank you very much for your call. Dr. Dorich, what about corn?
Yeah, so we talk often about the 8 most common food allergens in the United States, those that we have already mentioned. You can have a food allergy to really any food. And what becomes important here is combining the history of what has happened and the likelihood that we feel that this is causing the kinds of symptoms and the invocation of the type of pathway that is really consistent with what we traditionally think of as a type 1 food hypersensitivity or allergy. And there are commercial testings for many different foods. If there is not a commercial test available, we can perform a testing using the real food to get at the same information. The gold standard of diagnosing food allergy is really giving you the food. So taking somebody with peanut allergy, giving them peanut, and seeing if they have the symptoms that are suggestive of mast cell degranulation or your allergy cells being provoked. You know, this is something that we don't often do for really good reasons. You know, we don't want to provide an opportunity for somebody in the clinic to have anaphylaxis if we can avoid it. And so we really rely on history here and testing, if possible, to sort out food allergies. So corn could certainly be an allergen and could certainly cause symptoms. I think it's really important in these kinds of cases, however, to sit with somebody who has expertise in food allergy to review that history and to decide if testing and or challenge may be appropriate to determine whether the steps that you're taking are necessary. Because it is, as our caller mentioned, it can be very life-changing. And so we as allergists want to make sure we get the diagnosis right.
Mm-hmm. Lisa, and I don't know whether you can answer this question or not, but Lisa, who called in, said that corn is recognized as an allergen in Europe, but not here in the United States. Why is that? I mean, is it because of the different diets that you would see in different parts of the world?
You know, it's interesting because the U.S. has a process where the FDA makes the determination as to whether or not an allergen reaches a threshold, which means the number of people in the United States who have reported allergic reactions at a level of severity that it qualifies to be put on the label. Right now, one of the allergens that we are trying to get the FDA to approve for the purposes of labeling is sesame. Last year, there was a request for information that was put out. About 3,000 people responded. We have done research that shows that there are a greater rise of anaphylaxis due to sesame, around 800,000 people. And so once that threshold is met, we anticipate that the FDA, and one of the things that FAIR is actively working on, in fact, I'm headed to Capitol Hill today on this very conversation, is getting sesame added to the label. The Europeans have, where the U.S. right now has about 8 items, Europeans have, I believe, 15 or 16 that are required labeling rules. And it really depends on the way that the government body does the analysis as to the prevalence throughout that particular country or that particular region. One of the things also that FAIR is doing is we're working very closely with Grocer Manufacturers Association and its counterpart, Food Marketing Institute, which works with the retailers on something called Smart Label. And Smart Label is actually a place that is, you scan a code on from your telephone on the package, and it allows you to dig deeper and get more information. And what we're hoping is that because you have the rise of multiple allergens like corn that are causing problems, as they are for the Lisa who is on the telephone that needs to understand the ingredients of a product, we see the Smart Label as being a place where we can actually address at a deeper level the variety of different allergens in addition to whatever is required on package. And that should create a safer environment for everyone.
Dr. Dorich, Lisa, who called in, said that she finally realized this when she was 30. Is it unusual for a food allergy to show up at that age?
It certainly can be. So food allergy tends to present itself in adulthood for those foods which are consumed less often. So we see this often in the case of folks who like to have shellfish once a year when they take their trip to the beach.
Right.
And they find that one summer, things did not go so well. And this bodes a little bit toward the discussion for current therapies in treating food allergens in terms of continual exposure to something, lending itself to either this concept of tolerance, being able to tolerate a product, or unsustained responsiveness, which is another term that's being used in the research these days. But a food that's eaten more frequently and on a more regular basis is much less likely to be something that ends up triggering anaphylaxis. So we can certainly see food allergies present in adulthood, but if it's a food that's been commonly consumed or regularly consumed prior to that time point, it's much less likely. And I would, as an allergist, go looking for another explanation for the symptoms that presented.
Katie Moss, we talked about your son.
Noss.
Oh, I know that. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. That's okay.
Katie Noss, you also are a school nurse. So you are in contact and get to see children on a regular basis. What are you seeing? I mean, your observations with the number of kids, percentage of kids that are suffering from food allergies.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the statistics show that there are probably 2 children in each classroom that are suffering from some type of a food allergy. I think it's 1 in 13 kids are suffering from some type of a food allergy. So there are different things that we can do to help protect children in schools. And a lot of that relies on what the school's policies are and what the individual plans are for that specific child. Some of the things that we do would be to not bring in food items for parties or not bring in food items for birthday treats and things like that, to have non-food items instead. Because there are so many different types of food allergies, it's hard for people who don't have food allergies to truly be able to evaluate something, whether or not it would be safe for another person's child.
You know, that drives a lot of people crazy because they
it
say,
does.
Oh, that's not how it used to be.
It does.
Well, we had parties, Halloween parties, whatever. But I think this goes back to what you had been talking about earlier, that we're seeing an increased number of people who are suffering from food allergies, that it's just not safe to bring in a cake, peanut butter, whatever.
Right.
You know, that not everyone's going to react that way.
Yeah. And many children or many schools will say you can bring something as long as it's packaged and we can look at the ingredients that are in it, but not something that someone bakes at home, because we don't know that there may have been cross-contamination. Even if they think and feel that it's safe, it may not be safe. So.
Okay. Some emails here. Could additives to peanut butter be part of the problem for some?
So allergy to additives is very rare. It can occur, but the bottom line is it's quite rare.
Okay. Mary asks, can you outgrow allergies?
Yes. So this is very exciting. About 80% of kids who have milk and egg allergy outgrow those allergies. That means there is a percentage of kids who don't. Research over the past several years has also demonstrated that a protein structure, and this may be a little bit more complex, but protein structure is changed through the process of heating. So you can change how your body reacts to a food if you bake an egg, for example. So if you have something that contains egg that's been cooked at a high temperature in the oven, that can be tolerated, whereas something like a quiche or scrambled eggs on the stovetop may not. And so there are potentially varying degrees of outgrowing an allergy. And if you can tolerate one form of protein, you may be more likely to train your immune system to be able to tolerate other types. We also see this concept playing out for us in the new research that's on the horizon and which has been more recently discussed in terms of potential FDA approval. And that goes along the lines of oral immunotherapy. We have seen in these studies that kids taking small amounts with gradual escalation over time, that a proportion of those kids have, we're calling this sustained unresponsiveness as opposed to tolerance. And it's a small detail for the point of this discussion, but the point being that that we think that this process helps some kids to outgrow that allergy. That research is obviously still underway to see if those kids could stop eating or stop being involved in part of the study with those foods, and if that then becomes an unconcern for them in the future. But we know that there are folks who go through that process who avoid the food allergen for a period of several months, and then when re-challenged to it, do fine. And so the understanding of what causes the immune system to be able to begin to tolerate something or to outgrow something is still being worked out, really. But we're on an exciting horizon, I think, with respect to food allergy and the potential for treatments down the road.
Lisa Gabe, I'm going to ask you this question, but I may turn to our panel here in the studio for a local answer. Had a question about, are there any resources for uninsured adults struggling to find a definitive or a definite allergy diagnosis allergen test?
That I would actually defer to the doctor, who might have some ideas as to what's available in the state of Pennsylvania.
Okay, and that's what I figured you might say that because, but I was wondering if there was any kind of national trends, organizations that offer those tests. But Dr. DeDorch?
So I'm not familiar with any at this point in time, other than a good history can tell us a lot, even beyond testing. And like I said, the gold standard is really a challenge to that food. The other thing to remember with food allergy is that a true food allergy, and there's one exception to this, but I'm talking the general rule here, is that a true food allergy will cause symptoms every time you consume the food. So you should not be able to eat peanut on Monday and have a reaction, and then try to eat it on Wednesday, be okay, and then eat it again on Friday and have a reaction. Peanut, in that case, would not be the cause of your food allergy. So there is a lot by history that I can determine, even without the need for testing. I'm unaware of organizations that are providing kind of support for diagnosis of food allergy outside of kind of the insurance world at this time.
Let's go to the phone. Rachel is in McSherrytown. Rachel, you're on the air.
Hi. In this discussion, I'm noticing that there's something major that can cause food allergies. Babies, by the time they're 7 months old, have over two dozen doses of vaccines. And most people are unaware that vaccines legally can contain every one of the food allergens you're mentioning, and the vaccine manufacturers do not have to list it on the label. And when the amount of vaccines and doses have multiplied in children, if they're constantly injected with peanuts and wheat and soy and other allergens, to a vaccine, that can cause major problems with food allergies later. And that's what I think is a source that's not being discussed.
Thank you very much, Rachel, for your call. Dr. George?
So I would be very interested in reading the research supporting the evidence of food allergen in vaccine production. We know that in the case of flu vaccine, some flu vaccine is produced in eggs, in hen eggs. And so there has been a question in the past about folks with egg allergy being safe to receive flu vaccine that's been produced in that manner. The bottom line is that most of those folks can. But I'm not sure that the evidence supports the fact that food allergens are evident in vaccines. We certainly know that as a general rule, our population is vaccinated and that there are many children and adults who do not have food allergy who've received the same thing. And so I think that we have to be careful about the assumptions that we make in terms of what are potential factors for the development of food allergy. I think that it's good to keep an open mind about where we're seeing food allergy come from. But I'm not sure that the evidence at this point strongly supports that kind of reasoning.
Lisa Gable, have you heard of that?
You know, as it relates to the flu vaccine, and it highlights one particular issue. which is that it's very, very important to go to a certified allergist when you have these critical questions related to your health. Those are individuals like Dr. Dorch who are on the telephone who really have the understanding as to all the dynamics. In some cases, we do know that recommendations have been made to have the flu vaccine given in a different way to different types of children. But the number one issue is really making sure that you're seeing a pediatrician and a certified food allergist or a certified allergist, someone with the technical and medical background that the doctor has.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. For more information on food allergies, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. We are talking about food allergies on today's program. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalk. WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Our guest today, Katie Noss, a school nurse and mother of a child with a peanut allergy. Dr. Krista Dorich, Penn State Hershey. She's an allergy, asthma, and immunology specialist. And Lisa Gables, the CEO for Food Allergy Research and Education, also known as FAIR. Again, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Michael in Harrisburg. Michael, you're on the air.
Hello, Scott. Thank you. I'm a longtime listener, and thank you for your service to the community.
Well, thank you.
Okay. I developed food allergies in my 20s, and they kept getting worse. It started with dairy, and then went to wheat, and then went to soy, and then went to nuts and cheeses. And I went through the traditional doctors to diagnose what was the problem, and they were just having me eliminate those types of food from my diet. And with such a long list, it was very difficult to eat anything. And then when I would integrate it back into my diet over a short period of time, the allergies would come back. And how those allergies would show up in my day is tremendous amounts of mucus, congestion. Even a half a slice of bread, my head would become stuffy. It was hard to sleep. So I went through this for years and years and years with no real progress. And then I did some research online about leaky gut, which has to do with the digestion. And my digestion was damaged from processed foods and also glycemate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup. So the undigested food was going into my bloodstream. So once I started eating whole foods, I got rid of all processed foods, starting eating whole raw foods, also fermented foods like kombucha and sauerkraut and kimchi and miso. Within a very short period of time, my digestion had healed itself, and now I can eat anything with no effects.
Hey, Michael, go ahead. I want to ask our panel about that, because I got some other calls on the line, but the processed foods and leaky gut is what he's talking about, Dr. Dorch.
Yeah, so I think our discussion today has been mostly centered on type 1 mediated food hypersensitivity, which really defines a specific a pathway in the immune system that lends to the kinds of symptoms we had previously talked about in terms of potentially life-threatening reactions to foods. You know, there are other potential kinds of reactions to foods, some of which we have no available tests for, and some which, you know, the means of trying to sort out become complicated. And it sounds like you may fall into one of those latter categories. Our focus today has really been centered on these type 1 or these immediate hypersensitivity reactions.
What's leaky gut?
So leaky gut is as he was kind of pointing out, a fact of potentially proteins not being broken down quite well, and that process may lead to the immune system being exposed to different things than what it would be if that process were more intact, is probably the simplest way to explain it.
I have a feeling that you doctors don't refer to it as leaky gut.
At some points we do. You know, there's there's actually an immunodeficiency in young children that we refer to this process regarding. But the concept of leaky gut in terms of food allergy would be less well recognized or used.
What's the difference between a food allergy and food intolerance?
Yes, that's a very good question. And it all really hones back to this point that there are different kinds of reactions. So in general, the immune system, we break down into type 1, type 2, type 3, type 4, hypersensitivities, all defining kind of the basis for a reaction. Food allergy really refers to having an allergy cell called a mast cell that makes allergy antibody called IgE that causes degranulation or spewing out of products from this mast cell when it's activated that cause those symptoms we talked about, like trouble breathing, hives, throwing up. Food intolerances occur by a very different mechanism and do not tend to be life-threatening in general. And so often in these cases of food intolerance, like lactose intolerance.
Right, that's the first thing I was thinking
yes,
of.
Yes, and lactose intolerance has to do with an enzyme that you lack, and so you can't break down a sugar in milk, which is a very different mechanism than having a mast cell degranulate that could cause you to be unable to breathe. And so folks with lactose intolerance or even gluten sensitivity, which again is related to a different immune pathway, those folks can eat those foods. They may experience unpleasant side effects and can be debilitating even, but are unlikely and are not going to suffer the same kind of potential reaction that folks with true IgE-mediated food allergy like peanut allergy will suffer.
Let's take a phone call from Dan in York. Dan, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a nut allergy. I'm 65. For just about all my life, I could rely on food labels. And if I didn't see nuts on the label, I assumed it was safe to eat. And within the past few years, the manufacturers have started putting disclaimers on those labels that say this product was manufactured in a facility which processes nuts. To me, that means that I cannot rely on the label anymore. And I'm just wondering if your panelists have any advice about that or if there are any rules about why those are there or what they mean.
Yeah, Lisa Gable, I was going to come to you because this sounds touches on what you had talked about earlier. But what about that?
You know, it's actually one of the biggest projects that we're working on right now, which is trying to come up with a standardized precautionary label, which is what you're referring to. Currently, there are 40 different labels in market, and we know it's so confusing for the consumer, and actually the food and beverage companies aren't fond of it either. We recently put some research into the field with Northwestern related to what people would like to see on the label and what that label means to them. So what you should anticipate is that we are working on this very hard, trying to get everyone standardized on using the same precautionary language and then using Smart Label, which is the QR code that you can scan to allow you to dig more deeply into other types of questions you might have that are hard to answer on the extent of the package. But it is a very important issue. Everyone is working very closely together because we know it doesn't work for you, the person buying the food, and it doesn't really work that well for the manufacturers. And so we're hoping that over the next year, through this extensive research that we've put into the field over the last 3 months, that we'll be able to finally close the loop on the confusion that this is causing.
You know, it brings up a point, too, and I don't know, I'm sure that all our panelists have heard of this, but I actually know of a friend who used to work here at WITF, who was allergic to peanuts, was very involved with his church, was in Bolivia, of all places, helping to build a church. Was in a restaurant, asked if there was any peanut oil or anything. Was told no by the waiter. No, no peanut, no. Well, he had a severe reaction to the peanuts in Bolivia, where medical care isn't exactly, as good as it is here in the United States. He said it was one of the worst that he had ever had. Point is, accidental I imagine this happens all the time where someone who has a food allergy comes into contact with it, whether it's because of something not on a label or someone not having the information they need, that it happens all the time.
This is the great anxiety that a parent of a child with food allergies faces all the time. We've only been dealing with this allergy for 9 months, and I still have not let my son eat out at a restaurant because of that very reason. You always hear of these stories where, you know, everyone thought that it was safe, it was fine, the chef said it was fine, and then it turns out that it wasn't fine. And it was a mistake in everyone's well-meaning, but here you are with a child in the emergency room. So, and I know that people with food allergies do eat out at restaurants because you have to live your life and you end up having to take some risks if you would like to do that. But for my son, we have not yet done that. We are planning a trip coming up, so we're going to have to deal with that. And I, as a food allergy parent, have a lot of anxiety about dealing with that.
Dr. Dorch, what do you do?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, the recommendation to date has been to avoid the foods. That's been the only treatment, so to speak, that we can offer, really, to folks. I think that what you describe in terms of anxiety is very common for parents and later on for patients, especially as kids grow into those more boundary-pushing teenage years. This often becomes a factor as well when they're starting to go off on their own and they become more responsible before they truly have an understanding of maybe the significance of this food allergy. So we see this kind of anxiety all the time. I think one of the ongoing research opportunities in terms of this oral immunotherapy is meant to help provide some protection against those kinds of accidental exposures. And that's really where we stand in terms of future research at this point. And I do think that over the next several years, we may see a product for peanut in particular come through the process of the FDA pipeline and be approved so that folks may begin to be exposed to small quantities of peanut in over a year's time or so, be increased to the point where they could have a bite or eat the equivalent of a peanut or so, and not experience those kinds of severe life-threatening reactions.
You don't want to. No one can eat one peanut.
That's right.
So I would just stay away from it completely. And that's not Dr. Lamar's advice, by the way. A good time for a disclaimer that anything you've heard today, no diagnosis here. If you know you have questions, go to a doctor, go to an allergist, and ask those questions because everyone is different. Jennifer says, I'm interested in your panel's feedback on prenatal care and formula feeding in infancy. My daughters have food allergies, one with a life-threatening peanut allergy, the other with eczema and oral allergy syndrome, sensitive to melon, pea, coconut, soy, sunflower, and other foods. She outgrew peanut. Interestingly, both girls were adopted at birth. Neither birth mother had prenatal care, and both were formula fed. I always wonder if these factors contribute to their food allergies. The girls are ages 15 and 11.
The simple answer is we don't know. We know that there are however many children who are formula fed and who do not have food allergies. So I think the advice currently is that we don't do anything differently in pregnancy. And actually, early introduction is now kind of the standard or the recommendation.
Lisa Gable, we only have about 90 seconds left. Final word, advice for our audience after my disclaimer.
You know what? We're focused on funding research in this area. And as the doctor said, there are wonderful opportunities and a lot of people coming into the space to help mitigate risk with the goal of making sure that if you have accidental ingestion, we are hoping that therapies will soon be on the market, at least in the peanut area, that will help make sure that this doesn't become a life-threatening issue.
You know, for this entire program, I not only have had our two guests in the panel, but they brought along these teal-colored jack-o'-lantern. Does this one have a face on it? No, it's just a teal-colored pumpkin. And that one there is really freaky, by the way, that's been staring at me the entire program. What's with the teal pumpkins?
The teal pumpkins. So if you are out trick-or-treating with your family and you see teal pumpkins on everyone's doorsteps, it means that I'm doing a good job spreading awareness about the Teal Pumpkin Project. And the idea is if you put out a teal pumpkin, you're going to have non-food treats in addition to your traditional food treats or instead of your traditional food treats so that children with food allergies can participate fully in trick-or-treat night as well.
Well, that is good advice, because I would imagine trick-or-treat is one of those times where a child with food allergy, the parents are really, really anxious about that.
Yes, that is absolutely a fact. So it's great to see all the teal pumpkins that are out in stores. You can get them almost anywhere now. So.
Well, yeah, and that one is as scary as any jack-o'-lantern I've ever seen. It's a big one, too. I'll have to get a picture, put it on our website. Want to thank our guest for being with us today, Lisa Gable, CEO for Food Allergy Research and Education, Dr. Krista Todorich, Penn State Hershey Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Specialist, and Katie Noss is a school nurse and mother of a child with a peanut allergy. Thank all of you for being with us today.
You're welcome. You for having us.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much.